Clara, Catherine, and Calvin, and we get a second session. And next week we'll have a third and final session for the summer, where you get to kind of get a peek into some of the leader's favorite books. And some of them will surprise you, but they will edify you. And so if you have a chance to listen and grab some ideas of maybe this is a book I might want to read, go ahead and get on the website. And the last session is on there, and I have it all earmarked with Catherine's, Calvin's, and Clara's book reports. So we got three new book reports this week. And without further ado, our reading is so huge in the Christian life. Jesus came as the Word, right? And so it's so huge. And so we've got to discipline the mind. We've got to discipline ourselves to persevere in reading. And I'm not a natural reader, but I had to acquire it and acclimate to it because I realized you're transformed by the renewing of the mind. And the mind has to be, that's where your starting point is for transformation. So all of us need to be upping our game in that way. And when we do, because God gave us the Bible, He didn't give us the video. So He gave us the Bible, and the Bible is in words, and the more we can stay with the ideas of the Bible, the more we'll stay in the game, the more effective we'll be. But the more we gravitate away, and now instead of having large doses of Scripture, we can only take bite-sized tweets of Scripture, that's going to be detrimental to the long-term health of the believer. And I'm just saying this. I believe, this is just my own personal, I haven't my own personal belief, but I think Satan is so smart. He's such a mastermind. He's so forward-thinking. He's brilliant. He would make an amazing CEO in Silicon Valley. He knows how to strategize. And I wouldn't be surprised at all. I actually think that one of the ways he is trying to undermine the church is by giving them more and more pleasure and more fun and just momentary pleasure and less ability to stay with things. As he continues to let that slide happen, if you get a lot of people sliding out of concepts and out of ideas and be able to stay with it, you'll get people relying on feelings and the visual. And as you get more and more of a church that's doing that, that's less and less a threat to his army. And his army can overtake that. You know, when you're looking to strategize, I'm a coach. And I coach and I know what the other team's going to be doing. I know what the strategy is. So I've got to counter it with my strategy. And I've got to get my team ready for battle and ready to go try to contend for a CIF title. A lot of teams don't contend for it. They're not prepared for it. My teams, we will be in contention. We won't always win it, but we'll be in contention because we're going to prepare for success. And I'm so sure that Satan knows what he's doing in making things seem so fun and so cool, but at the same time, really just eroding the framework, the mind's framework. And so we want to call us back to what God is calling us to do. Not to not use those means, but not to rely on them for our food. It's like relying on chicken nuggets for your food. It's not going to be healthy for you. And so we want to get back to that's what our theme is, the books we love, so we can get back, get inspired and say, hey, that's a book I think I would like to read. So with that in mind, and it doesn't have to be, quote-unquote, a Christian book, but what I want you to be able to see is God is in everything. God is in all forms of life, all subject matter, all, you know, God, you can find God's way of working one way or another in there. And so I just gave the leaders free rein as to which books they're going to share, and I'm not going to share with you what they are. I'm going to let them do it. So we're going to start off first with Abigail. So Abigail's going to come and share. So welcome, Abigail. Abigail, I'm going to put this right here so you just... All right, and that's going to be recording. Okay. You want a mic? Yeah, let's take a mic. Okay. Let's use a mic. All right, so this is going to be great. Everyone's got 15 minutes, and then bam, we get to ask questions and stuff after. So as you're listening, feel free to get questions, jot it down in your mind, and then we'll interact at the end.
Hi. I'm a little sick, so if I cough or something, or yeah, then pardon me. But the book I'm gonna share about, I think most of you know it more by this. Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. So actually, when Peter Jackson did the film during the course of Noah's trilogy, so when Tolkien published it, it was meant to be one huge book, except it was easier to do it in three volumes, which is why there's three, but it's one, supposedly. Yeah. But I think some of you might know the story. It's set in a fantasy world called Middle Earth, where there is a Dark Lord called Sauron, and he has been defeated in a battle thousands of years ago. But then his life force is within the ring he made in the land where he ruled, called Mordor. One of the kings of the land, he took the ring, and it tempts you. So unless you destroy it within the fires of Mount Doom where it was made, then Sauron's life force still continues, and he can regain strength and come back. So that man, Isildur, that king, he failed to do that day, and so that ring was floating around somewhere, still attached through different hands, including a creature called Gollum, who used to be quite a normal person. He was kind of like a hobbit, one of the hobbit folk, really, which is like a person who is one of the races in that world who is half the height of a grown human, called halflings as well. So he had the ring for 500 years, and it got passed to another hobbit called Bilbo, who picked it up. And that I'll talk about in the prequel in The Hobbit, if you want to read that too, it's also very good. And then Bilbo, he passes this ring on to his nephew, Frodo. And the story is about how Frodo will take the ring, and he sets off on a journey with eight other companions, including three other hobbits, two men, one elf, and one dwarf, and the wizard Gandalf, to destroy this ring. Yeah. Now, with Tolkien, the ending of this is a happy ending. The world is safe, but not by Frodo's means. I'll explain that a little bit more. But when Tolkien wrote this story, he didn't mean it. He said he didn't mean for it to be an exact allegory of his beliefs, which was awesome, by the way. But he meant it to be like a story that could reflect certain truths, and I think it does, certain truths within the reality that we live in. And I think when I read it, it reminds me that we live in such a reality where there is always a fight between good and evil. So I think I'm going to go through 5 points that I think that there's a lot more, but these are 5 points that I think the book reflects about the reality that we live in here too. One, I think the ring reflects the nature of evil very well, in that A, it tempts and it slays, B, it is cunning, and C, it's parasitic and can destroy always. It can't create or save. A good example of that is when Gollum, he murdered his cousin Viggo, actually, to get the ring. So, and then afterward, poisoned his mind 500 years. Afterwards, he tried to murder Frodo and Sam for it as well, when Frodo was carrying it. In page 54, in Fellowship of the Ring, the first part, it describes kind of how Gollum felt about it. The thing was eating up his mind, of course, and the torment had become almost unbearable. All the secrets under the Great Mountains had turned out to be just empty night. There was nothing more to find out, nothing worth doing, only nasty, furtive eating, and resentful remembering. He was altogether wretched. He hated the dark. He hated light more. He hated everything, and the ring most of all. So he was obsessed with it, but at the same time, he hated it, kind of like a bad addiction. And possessed by it, consumed by it. Later on, another member of the fellowship, Boromir, was also obsessed by and tried to take the ring from Frodo. So that's another example. Number two, besides the ring being able to reflect the nature of evil, I think Tolkien's book also makes a lot of commentary on what we think is good and evil. Because in this book, there's a character, so-called quote-unquote good characters, that actually do bad things, and there are also bad characters that sometimes do good things. So, for example, I think the biggest person I can think of is Frodo himself. At the end of the story, he actually failed to drop the ring into Mount Doom. He had pored over it, and slowly it was like tempting him and telling him to take it for his own and take that power. And all along he said he was going to be the one to, you know, he thought he was going to be the one to drop it in there and like save little Earth, but he didn't. He actually failed because he didn't want to put it in the fire. He actually put the ring on, and Sam almost found out about it. But Gollum was there and kind of stopping him the entire time, and he acted as a guide. So he wanted it as well, and they had a big fight over it. He gnawed off Frodo's finger to get the ring, and then they ended up tumbling into the fire. Frodo ended up like just barely hanging on and got saved by Sam, so he didn't die. That's how the ring got destroyed, was because of Gollum. If it wasn't for him, Frodo had failed, actually. So he was actually a very good character throughout the whole thing. Showed a lot of pity to Gollum, and always had good intentions, but at the end he failed. So that's a good character who really, he failed in the end. So it kind of reminds me, like in the Bible, Romans 3:10, no one is righteous, not even one. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Three, I think there, it portrays like a longing for the return of the rightful king. One of the men in their fellowship, Aragorn, is the heir of the Isildur, so he's from the line of kings. That line was broken when Isildur died and was killed. But he, at the end, returned to reign over the world of men, and they were leaderless before, but he united them. And all along, all the race of men, they longed for that leader to come back, and that was Aragorn. He came back and reclaimed the throne at the end. That's kind of like how, if we're Christians, we Christians long for the return of Christ. Because I think we humans, whether we acknowledge it or not, in this life, we can't ever be satisfied or be at peace. And we feel like something is always missing unless things return to like their natural order where God is at the head. So there's that longing for that return of the rightful king where things are supposed to be. Four, I think Frodo is caught to a path that has ramifications far beyond himself. Kind of similar to how we are called to a task far beyond ourselves as Christians as well. Frodo has no idea what to do with the ring at first. He doesn't even know what it is until Gandalf tells him. And he doesn't know the war that rages in Middle Earth. He's taken out of his home of Hobbiton, and he's thrown into the midst of this war that, like, he learns determines the fate of his world. He's right in the center of it. So like Frodo, we're called to a task beyond ourselves, to build God's kingdom, to be witnesses of Christ, to show that love. And there's like an unseen spiritual battle around us. And are we aware of this battle, I think, or are we just content to stay in our own little hobbitism where we are and not take any risks? I think last thing, five, every person has a role in this grand story, whether it's good or bad. We don't know exactly how the great author will write it, but we can decide what we do each and every day. That I would like to read a passage from The Two Towers that kind of talks about that, touches upon that idea. This is Sam and Frodo talking. Yes, that's so, said Sam. We shouldn't be here at all if I'd know more about it before we started. But I suppose it's often that way. Brave things in the old songs and tales, Mr. Frodo. Adventures, I used to call them. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for. Because we wanted them. Because they were exciting. Life is a bit dull. Kind of a sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really matter, or the ones that stay in your mind. Folks seem to have been just blander than them usually. The paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances like us. A turning back, only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know, because they have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on. And not all to a good end, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story and not outside call a good end. You know, coming home, finding things all right, though not quite the same. Like Mr. Bilbo. Those aren't always the best tales to hear, though we may be the best tales to get landed in. I wonder what sort of tale we've fallen into. I wonder, said Frodo. Yeah, I don't know. And that's the way of a real tale. Take anyone that you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of tale it is, happy ending or sad ending. The people in it don't know. You don't want them to know. But then Sam goes back and forth, talks about some of the tales they know, and then he says, why, sir, I never thought of that before. You've got some of the light of it in that star glass that the lady gave you. Why, to think of it, we're in the same tale still. It's still going on. Don't the great tales never end? No, they never end as tales, said Frodo, but the people in them come and go when their parts ended. Our part will end later or sooner. But the idea is that there's like this continuing story and they have the part to play in it even though they don't know what it is, even though they're just two small little hobbits in the big wide world. So for us, I think what we choose to do each day, like if we know there's like a battle raging around us, just like they had in Middle-earth against Sauron, are we going to actively fight against it or just kind of trying to blind eye to it? And that's what I think of.